Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Welcome to this episode of Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, PPTS, the progressive radio show that asks the question, what are you going to do about it? Our show addresses the activists, activities, and activism across the United States from the progressive movement. Much more than a party or even a movement, PPTS is a show about action, what we believe the true purpose of a progressive to be. If you have a cause, a candidate, an issue, or a problem you feel needs to be heard by several thousand potential allies, this is the place for you. If you have a disagreement with something you see or feel or think about life where you live, this is the show for you. In fact, you're welcome to call in to our live show at area code 347-324-5825. Become a part of our live broadcast. You can ask your questions or make your comment. We'll respond after you hang up. Coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the mighty Duck River, I am the Tennessee Progressive. Welcome to today's show. Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. I am the Tennessee Progressive. I'd like to welcome our friends and our guests to today's show. It's going to be power-packed, and we have a lot of information to go over and to get out, so we're going to dispense with the usual preliminary amenities, and I'm going to go right to our first guest. Today's topic is a continuation of a series that PTS began about 3 weeks ago, which is generally referred to as the Battle of the War on the Poor. And the first area that we began to cover in this multi-campaign battle was the hunger cliff, and that started off on a series that was begun by an MSNBC journalist by the name of Chris Hayes, who really coined the phrase along with a couple of others, and talking about how people were one paycheck away from not being able to feed themselves, or those who were not working missing a payment or lessening a payment or, you know, any impact negatively on their income would basically propel them into a situation that they couldn't control and they couldn't stop. And it was generally referred to as the hunger cliff. Now, last show, we talked about it. And we described some of the folks, some of the actions, some of the resources, some of the effects that being near the hunger cliff was causing to American citizens. So the general thing was that it seemed on November 1st that several thousand Americans, maybe even millions of Americans, actually got kind of pushed over that cliff. So the next natural question was, well, who's doing the pushing? I mean, we're not going there voluntarily and like lemmings just jumping, so what's the deal? What's the big deal? And why? Why would anybody want to see Americans in this kind of food insecurity, this nutritional distress? Of course, it started with the rather well-known, highly visible
thanks to the reporting of several other people, the fact that the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program was being negatively affected, not necessarily by any cause of legislative or anything else. It was a stimulus that was created when we had the American meltdown, and it was set to expire. And the only way to keep it from expiring was to get together and deal with a farm bill, which was not really possible at the time because there was a lot of animus toward many parts of the farm bill, not among the least of which was some of our conservative brothers and sisters wanted to eliminate SNAP altogether, to defend against the possibility of that happening. The Democratic leader refused to bring the bill up. As a result of that, supplement expired, and $5 billion worth of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program went out the window. In December, sequestration is going to hit, and at least an additional $5 million is going to go into reduction of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Who is that affecting? We talked about it last week. Why are they rooting for that to happen? Is there anybody rooting for that to happen? What would happen if it did? Who would it impact? And why would they be rooting for it? What can we do? Our first guest is a man who's living this every day of his life. He's the director of the Colorado Food Project. And he is dealing not with the legislative issues so much first as he's dealing with the faces of the people who are hungry. He's on the ground. His organization is working to create solutions for the people who are the most negatively impacted by the hunger cliff. His name is William T. Browning. He's become a friend of this show through some rather excellent writing that I highly recommend to you. And he's with us for the remaining hour. William, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you for being with us today. How are you?
Good, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing all right. It's kind of technically pushy here. We're getting used to simulcast and technical glitches. This is a first full show for us with this new affiliation, so we're really grateful to the Coffee Party and the Netroot Radio Network and other groups who are coming together with us today to listen live to this. And we're very, very happy to have you with us. So I would like you to give us just a little bit, you know, about who William Browning is, where you come
sure.
from, how you got involved, and where you're at today.
So let me – I meant to correct your diary. I apologize. But I'm the board president for an organization called Hunger Free Colorado. And we're
Thank
a very
you.
Different organization. No problem.
Thank you.
My executive director, Kathy Underhill, is someone we need to have on your show because she's been one of the leading advocates in the country around really reframing hunger. We believe at Hunger Free Colorado that there's simply in this country no excuse for anyone to be hungry. And so what we advocate for is the end of hunger in Colorado. And what we mean by that is ensuring that every person has access to nutritious substance, which is critical. Nutrition was one of the key words. We want to make sure we have a discussion when we talk about this, the hunger issue. A couple of things I want to claim. You're absolutely right. I mean, right now, what called me to action to serve with Hunger Free was pretty clear. I came from an education background, working with various school districts on improving academic outcomes, and became very clear to me very quickly that you can't have high-performing students if they're not fed. And we've seen in Colorado, we've instituted things like school breakfast program and other legislative systemic changes which have resulted in significant improvements in classroom, both behavior and performance, as well as overall health of the kids. So what I've experienced in the hunger issue is less of an issue of trying to reframe this issue. Certainly it's a war on the poor, and certainly I believe we're firmly without any kind of a partisan perspective that cutting the SNAP program is paramount to treason. And the reason I say that is it's, you know, you have right now as of 2012, 49 million Americans are living in food insecure households. That's 33.1 million adults and over 15.9 million children. And when you think about that, in our country that we have 49 million Americans not able to ensure that they, and food insecure means they don't know where their next meal is really coming from. The SNAP program can go a long way to alleviating that. And I certainly believe the SNAP program is still, you know, vastly underfunded. But at least it's a systemic way to help families, children, and elder, family, children, elderly, an avenue to accessible meals and programs. So when I talk about the hunger issue, and we talk about it in Colorado, we really reframed this issue, and we tried to get rid of the political or partisan perspective as much as possible. So for Colorado, we've been successful because we haven't made it about left versus right or conservative versus liberal, but more about issues that people really can understand. So if you want great schools and you want your kids to perform well, which most people can agree is a good thing, you got to have school breakfast and school lunch programs that are nutritious. If you're against childhood obesity, if you're against, you want to see a healthier America, the irony is not lost that the hungrier you are in this country, the higher chance you're going to be to having significant obesity issues and other problems. Developing children in the early childhood space, if you're interested in making sure that we have a strong K-12 system, you've got to have great education, early child education system. And that requires having ensuring kids have nutrition to be actually and develop a healthy brain. From an economic development perspective, this is all about SNAP has a $1 to $1.7 return, which means that for every dollar you as an American give, you're creating $1.7 of economic outcome and activity. People cannot go out and use their SNAP money, debit cards, EBTs for strippers and cigarettes. They've got to use them for sanctioned food products. So to take a war on SNAP is really, you know, a war on all of us as Americans, because it hurts our economy, it hurts our schools, and it really hurts our national security. And what I mean by that is military more and more find harder, it's harder and harder to find adults who are not obese, and that's directly related and traceable to nutrition we serve. So that's my background. I'm very passionate about the cause because it makes sense on all levels. And I just firmly believe, but I know you do, that we live in the most prosperous, beautiful nation in the country. That we have people and kids that are hungry is unacceptable. And I'm a little different stereotype than most people advocating for the food side or the hunger side. I am a small business person, relatively middle of the road as far as my politics, and I just think this is a no-brainer. I think we got to rally more people to understand this is not a welfare program. This is not a giveaway. This is investing in our future. And if you really want to be, you know, our friends on the conservative side say we're all about cutting deficit and spending and so forth. But the reality is that it's exponentially higher and higher cost to basically starve your population and then deal with the consequences of and outcomes. Every scientific study has shown that it's going to be far more expensive for kids who don't get good nutrition early. So we'll be paying for that for decades.
Well, so of course, absolutely.
Please interrupt me anytime you need to.
I just wanted to break up a little bit and ask you a question because I think you fairly framed the process and the issue. What are you doing about it in Colorado? If you're addressing issues, what is it you're addressing?
So the big things in Colorado, we look at, if you're going to really solve hunger, you can't do it through food security programs like Food Bank and Emergency Food. But the irony there is that the $40 billion cuts that the House Republicans are talking about, there aren't enough food banks to make up that $40 billion SNAP gap. So we know for a fact, as much as we have good friends in the food bank industry, you can't solve it by just directing assets to food shelves. You've got to get systemic. So for Colorado, what we did is we passed the single most innovative statewide school breakfast legislation last spring. And this is significant because it has an impact. About 55,000 kids in Colorado will now get what we call breakfast after the bell. It's federally funded with state resources. It allows kids to have a breakfast. And let me tell you, having been a school board director, the difference between a kid who is who is a Fed in the beginning of the day, and their attentive span, they're all the things that that result from a kid that's well fed with nutritious food is fundamental. So that's one thing we're doing. We're also doing, we have really focused on some really cool innovation ideas with Hunger-Free Colorado. We have the first ever mobile bus that goes into high-needs neighborhoods where the people can't get to a county office or don't even have internet. The bus has internet connectivity and can actually, the only one in the entire country, can do real-time registration for the SNAP program. So people can get their EBT card right on site. No one else is doing that.
Really?
In addition, it's phenomenal. It's a really cool renovated RV bus. We got a couple of funders who share our passion for it. Other thing we've been doing is we've been doing systemic structures with the counties. County government, as you know, applying for food stamps and actually walking into a county to get your family food stamps is not a process that's filled with dignity. So we've been really working, especially the smaller counties and rural counties. I don't know Tennessee, your area very well. All my relatives are from your state, but in Colorado, you have a rural stigma with things like going into a county office and applying for benefits, especially if you're in a small town where everybody knows you. So one thing we've done is we were an advocate for the online capability for renewal and for applying, and then we're also a big fan of helping the counties with, processes that ensure dignity, empathy, and then also expediency, meaning we get people through those queues efficiently and effectively. The last thing we do is just the advocacy work we're doing now, which is why I'm on the phone with you. That, I wrote this piece, the diary you referred to last week, out of my frustration for national-level leadership that, we will give ConAgra and Coca-Cola and Kellogg and large-scale corporations billions of dollars for subsidy, but we won't put a fraction of that same amount into a program that actually has real economic development. Like I said before, it's a job killer. SNAP, not funding SNAP is killing jobs. Not funding SNAP is hurting national security. Not funding SNAP hurts our academic performance. So it's one of the few programs you have, federal programs, that really has the ability to make a difference across so many different levels. So that's what we're doing in Colorado.
How is that work being received by the legislature and the executive in Colorado?
So we have a very progressive governor, Hickenlooper. They're actually somewhat conservative. He's kind of, he's one of those interesting guys who's, he's very, clear on helping with the younger issue, but at the same time, he likes fracking and oil and gas. So, one of those, he's kind of a hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to lock into any kind of, he's a Democrat, he's a Republican, blue or red. But I will say this, I think he was very supportive. In fact, he was the first governor to sign off on this program. And we had national level funding support, and we're grateful for our support from Sheriff Strength out of Washington, D.C. And what the legislature was, the reason we got the conservative votes on this was because people like me I'm a business person, were able to make the argument not about a welfare, Ronald Reagan, welfare queen kind of crap. It was more about, look, this has a viable economic return. So this is one of the few federal programs. You give me a dollar, I employ somebody. You give me a dollar, I feed somebody. You give me a dollar, I make a kid, perform better in school. It doesn't get much better than the utopia that you have here as far as what the SNAP program can really do here. It's really interesting about how many facets this program really has as far as impact. So we reframed the argument, we've gotten a lot more success. When I first started with Hunger Free Colorado, it was hard for me to make that. I thought, well, we'd be talking food bank and those kind of traditional avenues. But we don't. We talk about it as economic development. In Colorado, before Hunger Free Colorado was accepted, we left $77.8 million of SNAP money on the table, meaning that we had so many people in Colorado who were eligible for the benefit but weren't taking advantage of it. Well, $77.8 million is 36 major grocery stores operational full-time 24/7. Do you realize that? Do you know how many jobs 36 grocery stores creates? You think about it from a supply
depending
chain.
On the size of the grocery store, if you're talking about Spaceway and Albertsons and King Stupid's and the neighborhood.
That's why on our board we have a mixture of people who are representing interests, which people would say are partisan conservative. We have Walmart on our board. And they're on the board for the same reason. They see the economic throughput of a SNAP program. They're not stupid. The grocery store chains, Kroger, Alberts, they have somebody to gain here. And there's nothing wrong with having big business gain with gain with the poverty. And that's one argument I fight with the left on, which is like we gotta get everybody in on the same page here. It helps the poor, it helps the hungry, it helps the kids, it helps business, it helps our national security. It's patriotic, it's the right thing to do. It isn't a partisan issue for me. It's frustrating that it's become some kind of partisan issue on the right. And I think congressmen who vote against the SNAP program are either really misinformed, unethical, or just plain ruthless, in my opinion.
Well,
all three.
I think that's where this particular episode comes from, because I don't understand why anyone would voluntarily push that entire list you just spoke about over the hunger in the name of political sense. It doesn't make any sense at all to me as a citizen.
It doesn't. It doesn't make much sense, sir, either to, Bob Dole wrote the LA Times editorial just a few weeks ago, which I thought was brilliant.
Right.
So here's Bob Dole, the standard bearer of the Republican Party just a few years ago, making the same argument, like Bob Dole or not like Bob Dole, but he's saying this is not an area where partisan interest should be at play here. I think tragically in our country, I think there's the question I ask in my diary, which we do not want to address, is really, we're persecuting 40 million Americans for being hungry for this policy. We're not asking the question which needs to be asked, is why do we have 40 million Americans, most of them, by the way, on the SNAP program are working adults. You can only be on SNAP 90 days for a time. But you're also, you expect the Republicans come back and say, well, we need them to work. Well, 70% of the people on the SNAP benefit are not in the working category. They're children, they're elderly, they're disabled. So it's a ridiculous argument. But I think we need to ask ourselves for, the McDonald's expose just a few months ago was, or a few weeks ago was interesting, right?
Yes.
You have fast food industry acknowledging, and actually not only acknowledging, but advocating their employees, directing their employees to the SNAP program, because those two, the executives at McDonald's, are all too aware that the wage they pay a McDonald's employee is never going to allow them to actually have a sustainable diet. It's tragic. It's frustrating, because if you think about if you actually had a living wage, what that actually would mean for the big business entities, So
A lot of these people that you're talking about, especially Walmart employees, McDonald's employees, you talk about 70% being outside the employment range. But of those people
right.
who are in the employment range, a very high percentage of those people are working one or maybe two jobs, or single
That's
parents
right.
with multiple children,
right.
and
exactly
they
right.
cannot afford to live with two jobs, and they are on the SNAP program.
That's exactly right. I mean, I don't know if you saw the recent movie, and I encourage your listeners to watch the movie, A Place at the Table, which is a documentary out about a year ago. Fantastic documentary, exactly that issue. And for me, it was hard because watching the movie because it had a small town in Colorado just down the road here. And you're exactly right. It showcased that most of the people in that town, 80% of the town is Colburn, is in some level of federal subsidy or SNAP program. And almost all of those people, and I grew up in a small town in Colorado, work. Some of them work two jobs, and they're still unable to really figure out how to put the next meal on the table. And tragically, when you're at a low income, I don't know if you've ever encouraged your listeners to take the SNAP challenge, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Okay.
You can't live on it. You can't maintain a healthy diet because the stuff that is subsidized by the U.S. government is highly caloric and usually the junk food. The fresh fruits and vegetables and other types of produce are not, and they're more expensive. So when you're faced with how do I spend my, $1.78 or $1.82, whatever it is, a day, or it becomes pretty clear you're not going to be buying a lot of produce. It's just a bad equation all around. But you're absolutely right. It's you're really hitting the working poor, not just the poor, but the working poor, and that to me. That's what really bothers me. If I got a single mother working all, slaving away, and I know how it is to have a new baby, can't imagine not being able to having to make a decision. Okay, I'm gonna decide which child eats tonight, or I'm gonna sacrifice my own child or my own health for my child's health. And it just from a big business. My argument with Republicans is a simple one, right? It's like you're it's not going to, it's, you're cutting, it's a short, a very stupid short-term gain to keep the wages as low because you're cutting that buying power out ultimately. But not only
well,
that,
you guys,
yeah.
You guys are actually facing that on the ground. I mean, you're looking people in the face who are making these decisions, right? These are the
yeah,
people
so we
you're
have,
trying to help.
Yeah, we, yeah, our organization has, we were the first one, we have what's called the Hunger Free Hotline, which encourages people to call in. It's one of the first prototype statewide hotlines that address people. So, yes, we are. We are dealing with people who are, it's tragic. We just did a symposium called Hunger Through the Lens, which was women were given a camera to really, to focus artistically on their view of hunger. And it's shocking and it's unacceptable that you have people in this country of great wealth and the American dream, where they're choosing, you know, which child is, you know, they're making these decisions about who eats and who doesn't in their family, and that to me is unacceptable. So they photographed that. We talked to these women, and they're real people and they're working. And I think my frustration is I think we should award those that work. I have no problem with being conservative when it comes to people who don't want to work and who want to, you know, and I think that stereotype is extremely, from what I've seen, pretty rare. I don't meet a lot of
yeah.
people who are taking the benefits, take the benefit. I think that's just
right.
nonsense. So I do see a lot of people. Most people
are, yeah,
but, yeah.
I'm sorry, I've got one more question. And that Hunger Free hotline is a major piece of news. I don't know that that's replicated anywhere. So I'm also aware that you recently went through a bit of a tough stretch in Colorado, especially in Weld County. Mother Nature paid a visit to you. How
right.
has that impacted your program? I'm talking about the major flooding that went on in Colorado.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Recently.
Well,
how has that impacted
yeah.
your program, and does it give you an access point to another population?
Well, actually, it was interesting you were bringing it up. We actually were able to help the governor's office and coordinate not only the floods but the fires of last year. So Hunger Free has been able to leverage what's called the SNAP-D benefit, which is a SNAP disaster benefit. It's a specific SNAP program for people who are facing a natural disaster or some type of impact from their food insecurity is impacted or disrupted from natural causes. So we actually, Hunger Free was able to use the hotline, and we were able to use our resources and help county and state officials ensure that people who never had been in that position before having to need a SNAP benefit were taken care of. It was actually very successful. And it's interesting you bring this up. I mean, the real issue, if you talk about people being exposed to hunger that were different, 2000, I would say 2007 to 2010, you had a very different demographic that was suddenly hungry in this country. And that to me was kind of the starting point of this discussion, like, wait a minute, you know, we're hitting a slippery slope where people who are working, you know, potentially lower middle class are suddenly not able to provide meals for their family. I think the larger discussion is, you know, what in this country, what do we really value? We really value work. We really value
right.
business and economic development. Then you can't not have the conversation about, well, what can we do systemically around hunger?
Yes, so I agree with you. I think it's imperative that we have that conversation now because it's a mostly unseen, unfelt reality from those who actually were the first victims of the American meltdown, and that was the middle class. Everybody thought it would be the lower class, poverty class, that would be hit, but it wasn't. There wasn't any more that you could do to them. What happened was it was the middle class who
right.
suddenly went through the floor. And these people that were
right.
engineers and teachers and doctors and nurses and cops
mm-hmm.
were
right.
suddenly competing with teenagers for jobs. There weren't any. And the backwardsness of this is we're going to take away the funding for the SNAP program to make people work. Because as we all know, everybody who gets food stamps is a taker. That's the term that's been used.
Right.
And that's the story that's being told. The story that's not being told is, A, why that happened, and, B, why the conversation seems to be, let's get everybody off this support social network like we've been fighting since 1935, and we're going to have that battle again. But this time we've got, you know, if we put the numbers of people that are involved in this program right now back to 1935, it would be approximately one-third of the population of the United States. And today, we don't even know with reality the number of people. We get statistics from the Agricultural Department and the SNAP system and stuff like that, but those are rolling numbers. We don't have a static number. We just know that it went from 20 million to 47 million during the period of what's called the American meltdown, and it's still growing. So something has happened that we can't or are not controlling. Now, there's another person that wants to join our conversation, and I would like your permission to bring him on. His name is Egberto Willis, and he's not only a well-known writer, but he's a member of the Coffee Party Board as well, who has a lot to say about this. And if it's okay, I'd like you two to have a conversation. Would that be all right?
It's your show, for sure. Yep, it's your show.
Okay, thank you. Egberto, are you with us?
Yes, I am. First of all, Bud, welcome aboard with your show. I mean, I sat down here listening, and I tell you that where you're going with the conversation, I simply love it, because I think you guys are doing great. I think we need so much more of this, because as your guest was saying, and forgive me that I don't remember his name.
It's William Browning.
Yes.
Known on the coast as W.T. Browning.
W.T. Browning. There we go. W.T. I've seen your name all the time on coast. I think it is so important for us to actually be more vocal. We're not going to see this on the 5 o'clock news, the 6 o'clock news, and national news. It's just not going to happen. But I love the way that he is talking about actually attempting to get the message out. I know that all of us are on coast trying to do our job to get this message out. But again, I think we somehow have to find a way to personalize this a bit more so that our message will multiply and that we finally force these guys in the, we can't use the mainstream media anymore. I think guys like Coast would go crazy, the traditional media. We have to get to the traditional media to really show them what's happening in real America, because nothing that you see on TV is real America anymore. I don't know if these guys have ever been to real America, what's going on. I can tell you on a personal basis how policies themselves, the type of policies that we've even, not only with let's say, the SNAP program that you're talking about that affects, let's say, the folks on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, but as you were just saying, the middle class, I can give an example being the policies that we have with the offshoring of jobs and offshoring of technology. Somebody like me who programs or have a software business, programs for a living, to watch how that has gone offshore, to have a sister who is a doctor and understand that a lot of the radiologists now that were gainfully employed in the United States are no longer so, because they can be shipped over the internet to be interpreted overseas at one-fourth or one-fifth the cost. It's just amazing, and I don't think many Americans know this. So the more you guys do what you're doing, the more I think that message gets into folks' minds.
Bill, William, have you seen any impact in the local about...
Well, I think all politics is local. I think perspective is that, yeah, all things are local. So, I mean, especially in the Hunger Games. So I think I agree that I don't think advocating through the mainstream media and, is going to be a successful campaign. I don't have any debate about that. I think where I look at it, though, is building coalitions that normally would not be seen as coalitions. So in the Hunger Game, you know, fighting the hunger issue, look, I'll be blunt. If you can figure out, the Tea Party is eroding the traditional Republican value of big business. I mean, this idea that the Tea Party and Republicans are big business is really, I think, nonsense. I think they're more about the 1% than big business. And, you know, SNAP program hits big business. It hits mid business. It hits small business. It hits the supply chain. So I think when you talk about can we get more vocal and move the needle, you've got to get different people who may argue on, may not necessarily agree on all principles, but can agree on some starting points. I think we can all agree as Americans that no kid should be hungry in school. And if we can get people to that, you know, in Colorado we got people there. And once you get people there and you realize you can make those systemic investments and they have a good return. A good return is not just you know, the kids are healthier and better. That's what the outcome should be. But the good return is that you're actually engaging. It helps the economy. It helps the business. It helps farmers, you know, for example. It helps truck drivers getting stuff to market. It helps. It has a uniform immediate impact. It's not like national defense where you pay for a program, you create a few jobs, and you don't see it. But you see it locally if you get these programs. So, you know, we've been very successful in Hunger Free building unique coalitions that come in and say, look, on one side I've got the liberal coalition of people who are, you know, social justice and fanatics about civil liberty and, you know, rights. And the other side I've got people from Walmart and J.P. Morgan Chase and others who represent the business side. And together we all feel that no children should be hungry. So we have different motives for acting, but it's about getting the local, you know, movement. So, you know, the next crisis that's coming up in the hunger side, in our opinion, from our perspective, is the senior population. There's going to be a mass drain of this country already happening, and the numbers around solving senior food shortages is staggering. So while you can feed kids pretty easily through SNAP programs, SNAP breakfast programs, suburb programs around schools, the adult, older adult program is going to be our next big challenge. But I want to argue, I think you can get people locally, you get these velocities working. I think the answer is the state legislature. The problem you have right now is you have these idiots in the Congress who will limit even that ability for states to move forward if they cut SNAP. If they cut SNAP by $40 billion, you're going to erase most of the gains that we've done in the last, you know, last decade as far as helping drive innovative strategies, because that SNAP funding is the bucket that states pull from for a lot of their hunger mitigation programs.
Right.
So the tragedy here is that, you know, how do we get, you know, I think, you know, just to be blunt, I think we've got to do a better job of lighting up some of our bigger business brethren. And as much as we want to hold our nose sometimes when you want to work with business, you've got to make this about things that, you know, it's about the economy and economics as well as helping the poor. And I think you put it all together, I think there are organizations like Share Our Strength and Hunger Free and others nationally have done a good job of bringing in unique coalitions that can, you know, can get changed. And I think we got to start shaming these politicians, both Democrat and Republican, who do not support the food. Look, it's unacceptable. Debbie Stabenow and the senior Democrats are killing, you know, putting any kind of cut reduction on the table for SNAP. It's unacceptable. We cannot accept that. So, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that a lot, but I wonder sometimes. You just said two things: shame the businessman and shame the politician. I think at this point in time, there is no shame for either, because what they've done in the narrative is they've made evil bold. They've made supporting things like austerity bold. They have changed the narrative in such a manner that being wrong or being evil to kids, meaning starving kids. I mean, if you hear the message on the floor in Congress, there was a congressman that gets up and said, if you can't work, you don't eat. This Ayn Rand type mentality, they were actually even having folks without thinking it is okay. So I think it's, you know, I don't know the shaming of the leaders is the successful point as much as the education of the people, more so, because the educated person would then elect that person that is more in tune with them. Right now they think they want these things. They think they want to reduce.
But you,
they
you
want
have a, you have a, but my argument to that is that if you look at, like, we don't have a democracy in this country as far as I'm concerned. We have people who are...
You're right. You're right.
So I would agree with that. I'd like, show me the money. And the money is, the money for the Republican or people who are holding the strings here, we need to go after their funders and help the funders. So, again, back to, if you look at SNAP, if you look at, for example, what kind of companies are impacted by SNAP? You've got food agricultural production, you've got shipping, you've got oil and gas, you've got farming, agriculture, you've got
transportation,
obviously grocery, retail, everything. And I don't think we're, and I think in Colorado we made a good effort of saying we got the grocery stores together and said, look, you know, I guess with the stat I brought before, SNAP, you know, the inability for us to get 100% enrollment on SNAP cost us $77.8 million or 36 grocery stores. Can we get you on board here? Because there's a natural play for business to be important. And when those guys lit up and said, hey, I never thought about it that way, and I think we would like to come with you to help, we suddenly got more conservative, you know, people, Republicans in this state say, you know what, that's right. Because you can't, if you put them in a position where they say I'm for big business, or I'm for business, I'm the party of big business.
Yeah, or
and
small
yet they're
business.
Cutting this. We even got the Chamber of Commerce here locally to be supportive of this because they get it. They realize that it's about the outcomes are important from an education perspective, but that's why I think, you know, coordinating with I think that we got a fringe element in the U.S. Congress that Republican House that is, unfortunately, I think you're right. They're not going to be shamed. They're not going to, you know, they're not interested in anybody who's willing to shut down our government, put people into harm's way.
Well, let me interject here. I'd like to get some real numbers here. For both William and Egberto, by the way, William, if you don't know, is in Texas, which has a particular part to play in the story.
Sure,
William, can you tell me the amount of dollars that are funded in the SNAP program in the state of Colorado, how much federal money comes, and if there's state money, how much that is?
Off the top of my head, I have to look at my numbers, Henry. It's probably not. Hold on. Just 1 second.
And Egberto,
I would say it's probably about because that's $77.8 million on the table, which is about 50%. So you probably guess it's probably about $160 million of federal money in this economy.
In Colorado.
Yeah.
$160 million. And Egberto, do you have any baseball numbers?
Yeah. I am actually looking for the numbers, but it's not very high at all here in Texas. In fact, we are one of the worst states with respect to because you know there's a component from the state as well.
Well, there certainly
but
is.
I don't have that in front of me right now. I'm looking for it.
Well, keep looking for it, and I'll ask William another question. If you've got $160 million in federal aid coming into the budget in the general fund of Colorado, what's your estimation of our ROI on that $160 million?
Oh, it's astronomical. I wouldn't even know.
I know federally
the
federal number is $1.80, but I don't know if that's
more or less in
Colorado.
I think the problem you have with it is a couple things. One, the quantitative outcomes are pretty easy, but the qualitative outcomes. So the question is, like, our school breakfast legislation program. The ROI outcome I would care about as much as even the 1 to 1.8 or 1.75 or 1.9. It's the outcome on
the quality,
the academic performance, and health, the quality of education, and that's the thing too. I mean, we've got conservative friends who've convinced on the education side. You know, you have people saying we want to help, improve academic outcomes, and they're conservative in that regard, and they've kind of come around over the last year or two. So in Colorado, I'm encouraged that we have some of the conservatives in Colorado coming around saying, yeah, you know what, if we can't feed them, we're just wasting millions trying to move the needle.
Yeah, I was.
You have a great school, great teacher, and poor nutrition. You're not going to have the outcomes you want versus a school that has great teacher. Great leadership and sustainable food. It's a remarkable
thing. There was a great piece done for television that had an interview with a child who was meeting every available qualification for SNAP program. She was homeless. They were living in a shelter. She went to school. And she said that she spent her day dreaming of fruit. That's all she could think about. She would see her teacher, and all of a sudden she would see a banana.
That's exactly right. How do you teach
a child that is in that mental position? You talk about, you know, public education is failing us. Well, Okay, let's presume for a moment that's true. If you start to look at some of the ranking factors, one of the things that teachers, and I have been one for a very long time, and I did a very lot of teaching in Colorado, by the way, before I attacked the Aurora School Board. The reality of the situation is that among the first qualifiers to education is prepared children. And teachers are having to deal with making sure their kids have breakfast because there's nobody else in the system outside the family that can even see this. That takes away important teaching opportunities and teaching time from the classroom.
No, no question. No question.
Because, you know, you're having to police
right.
even more than usual the home situation.
That's why we advocated. That's why we were successful during the school education path for school breakfast. And we did it, but we didn't do it with a liberal or conservative agenda. We did it with an agenda that made economic sense. And you're exactly right. And if you talk about teachers, and I've in my former role, I was a school board chair, and it was night and day, the class performance between before the school breakfast and the year before we had the school breakfast. The ability for kids to be disruptive, the kids for them to be attentive, it's remarkable. I think I'm encouraged, maybe I'm an optimist, I just think in this country we got to continue to make, we got to pull these unique coalitions together, and I don't know if we're, I had the conversation with our country's leadership about the fact that we don't have enough. We're not paying our people living wages. We're not. That's a different issue. It's tied obviously at the center together. I'm not gonna argue that. But we're trying to Hunger Free to take very clear strides on putting systemic structures in place to really get this issue head on. And what I mean by systemic is they're not. They're sustained through, the school breakfast program is legislated, it's in place, it's there. It's very hard to take that away.
Are these programs sustainable over long term?
Yeah, they certainly are. Sustainability is an interesting word. I mean, not sustainable is if you have a K-12 system in Colorado that doesn't produce good results. I mean, so I think we argue that from a sustainability perspective, again, going back to economic development, there are programs the government can make that make sense. From the moral reason to do them as well as the economic reason to do them. I mean, we pay taxes, and ideally our tax dollars are used wisely by our political friends, and they come back in the form of supports to the American people. That's what it's for. I mean, people play me like this argument about building infrastructure, and it's like, yeah, it's that's what we should be doing. I mean, it's
but
yes,
this whole issue of debt reduction really pisses me off, because what we're really saying is we're willing to, as a generation, we're willing to pay a lot more for obesity and a much more ignorant population and a much less secure country by making the kind of tactical decisions which seem like, oh, we're cutting $4 billion off. Aren't we so smart? We're cutting $1 billion off this program. I'm convinced we can get those people to realize the benefit, but I think it's getting these coalitions that have a different voice and a more powerful voice tied to the dollar that, if suddenly a politician's funder is saying, hey, you know what, this is matters to us and we need it to matter to you, that's a different conversation than some of the activists can have, you know what I mean?
Right, and I think the more we move this conversation into the public area, the more we're going to find that people are aware of this. They're not going to be told secrets that they don't know, because they're the ones that are being impacted, and they're going to have the long memories that this political move you made, we don't accept, and we're going to show you, and we're going to show you at the ballot box, because you're attacking it's not our way of life that you're attacking, it's our lives. And that is going to, and it already is, by the way, having that effect. Go ahead, Egberto.
Yeah, this is actually important, and something that just shocked me in reading this. You were asking about how much money in food stamps does Texas dole out. It's actually $6 billion a year. Last year, and it's interesting because in Texas, there are 4 million people on SNAP. We spend $6 billion. California is a much larger state, and they spend $7.1 billion.
Right.
We are the one that have the most people. I knew we were the ones with most people on the program. I didn't understand, or I never actually looked up specifically for Texas, how bad it was. I just knew the numbers that it was the top. But
yeah,
let me just say one quick thing here. It's pathetic that we allow our governor, Rick Perry, to go around talking about the Texas miracle when, for all practical purposes, we can say that that miracle, the tax breaks that they're given to companies to come here and make this working miracle is done on the backs of so many.
Absolutely.
It's just upsetting to watch these numbers.
Well, you had a situation in Longview this week that made the national news regarding this food stamp SNAP program, reduced student lunches. You had a student who was 30 cents short on their food account at the cafeteria.
39 cents short.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, I didn't quite get the full story, but as it turns out, his lunch, he actually had his – they were prepared to give him his lunch, and he was short by 39 cents. And all they did was instead of – look, I'm sure one of these ladies would have also given the 39 cents, but I think it's a bit deeper than that. This has to do with – remember earlier when I mentioned that we have made it vogue to be evil, vogue to be to wrong people?
Yes.
This, I think this is what it's all about, because you and I remember the days that we were in school dealing with those that were adults. And if a child is short 10 cents or 15 cents or and 39 cents in today's money compared to what it was like when we were young, it's a pittance.
Mm-hmm.
And that somebody just throws his food in the trash because he can't afford it, as opposed
in front
to
of his
giving
eyes.
It to him. Yes. It is a sad commentary, and that's what I'm talking about when we talk about how do we shame people into doing things. Well, we have allowed for so long that attitude that person that isn't working, it's their fault. That person that gets sick, it is their fault. That fat person, it is their fault. William said it great earlier when he talks about the only food that the poor can afford are the foods that are unhealthy, high in all the wrong calories, and make them that way. So, we are blaming folks for a lot of things that society as a whole and bad policy as a whole is actually affecting. So, when William talks about, I love what he's talking about. I would love to find a way, and believe me, I'm trying. I know you are trying, Bud. I know William's trying. But I would love to find a way for us to use the methods that we have. At Coffee Party, we have what's known as Be the Media, where we are trying to get information out through the channels. At Coffee Party, we have over, I think, 500,000 people that we have access to through this network. And with Move to Amend, which stands on the same types of policy, getting money out of politics, we have attempting to get that message out. But we have to come out with something using Daily Coast, using all these avenues to capture the segmented market, because from what people are seeing on TV from our politicians, give them permissions for all the carnality of your evils to come out. I don't know the specifics of what that child looked like or what the person who threw the food in the trash looked like. But one thing I do know is that woman who was serving him food was just likely a step above his financial state. But she or he felt some sort of a carnal angst towards that kid's poorness, if you will.
And
that is what
get out
of discussing about it.
And as a food worker at a public school, I would imagine, to be quite honest with you, that it was entirely possible that her economic condition was worse than his.
Exactly.
That's a picture point to a conversation. We want to have the conversation with the people who matter most. That's why I'm so glad that you are here, both of you, because you are you're the boots on the ground. You're the ones. Egberto is very busy reporting these things. And Egberto, I would say that the Coffee Party has a large opportunity, which is why I'm glad this show is here, to create the conversation amongst the people who matter most. And I don't know that you've ever, as a Coffee Party, I've been a member since the beginning, but I don't remember us ever having any kind of outreach or conversation about food insecurity. The network that is joining us today is a simulcast. Go ahead.
Bob, that is what, you know, I mean, we have a lot of voices. And first of all, happy to have you on board. I know you've been a Coffee Party person a long time ago. It's great having you on board here with the station. I mean, we all have areas that, you know, slip us by or that we don't
absolutely don't
think about. And that is what's great, bringing on all these different voices that tell us what we – that in other words, you having this program gives me yet another thing that I need to add to the repertoire of getting noticed out there.
Just what you needed, right?
Exactly.
The thing is that Bush came in and George W. came in with this idea of being a kinder, gentler nation. And it seems like the opposition to the Republican Party, the Tea Party, has decided they're going to be a rougher, meaner nation.
Right.
And that is why there is a schism in the Republican Party, and it's going to be interesting to watch. I've never lived in a time where there was a definitional implosion of a political party, but I think we're seeing it. Unfortunately, it's happening on the backs of the least among us. And
you know,
when you,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
When you've got people like William out there every day, and this is where I want to go to close this section. William, how can we help you? How do we contact you? How do we get to you so that we can help you?
Yeah. So again, my organization, you know, and again, Kathy Underhill is our executive. It was really the I'm on the board, so I wish I was more on the ground every day. You're giving me too much credit. I'm engaged how I can be. But Kathy Underhill and her team, what I'd like to do is figure out how to connect her into, so we could talk about states like, she's already working with other states. We're modeling. Colorado's seen as a hunger innovation state. We've gotten a lot of attention around
right.
The innovation things we've done. So my recommendation is simple. I mean, I think we can connect leaders like yourself, people, community advocates, to Kathy, and there's some things that she's done. Again, she's gotten a different coalition of people together because she talks about hunger differently, and I think to me that's the key. I think it's if you try to make it, you try to fight it on the ground that we've been fighting on, you're going to lose. But if you start fighting on a different ground of jobs, national security, early childhood, and excellent national competitive, global competitiveness of our country. It becomes a very, very different discussion. It becomes much harder to defend against those things. So I think, Mike, to just long-winded answer, I think let's I'm happy. You know Mike Phil's ID. I'm not as active on there as you guys give me credit for, but I'm a good I've been actively following the issues. But I'm happy to connect with our organization. I think what you do is you get Kathy to start talking with other people who have the same kind of passion. And the difference between Hunger Free and a lot of other organizations across the country is that Hunger Free's identity is not again about food, emergency food or food banks. We've done is we've made it a much higher political. You know, it's about the systemic change. It's about things that can be sustainable. It's about engaging those that we think might be our enemies, but actually might be our best friends in some of these fights, and having moving the policy. So I think she's the one that's really the boots to the ground leader, and I can't, you know, she's the one who inspired me to be active.
As I've told you before, I'll have her on the show next week if she'll show.
Yeah, I think I just think.
Let's consume.
Yeah, I think you'll be much more impressed by her than you are by me.
I don't think so.
You actually will be. She's the innovator.
You're a great spokesman, man.
Well, I care about the cause. I care about our country, as I know you guys do. And I think we've got to figure out how to have a very different conversation. And I think. I'm optimistic about what we could do here as a country, but I think you guys called it out right. I think this almost this hatred toward each other is really the problem here. And so I think maybe making it about something else that people can get grasp around. And I think the bottom line is we have to do it. I mean, we can't can't imagine this country if it continues to go the direction it's going, where we see, I did a lot of work in the city of Port-au-Prince in Haiti a few years ago,
oh, yeah.
where the distinct difference between the 99% and the 1% is physically clear yeah. as it can be. And if there's any illusion in this country, that the continued erosion of the middle class is not possible to the point that we're living in the tents and people are living in the mansions, I think that is my fair. Haiti served as a fair warning to me that it's all possible to slip away this beautiful country we have. So
yeah.
I got to close. Gentlemen, I got to leave because my wife is signaling me that a baby needs some attention. And I really appreciate your patriotism and what you guys do, and I hope you guys I'll connect you with all the people I know, and I appreciate you guys standing up for those that really need it.
Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for the wonderful article which began this conversation. We will continue it, and I'd like to have you back.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Egberto, what do
bye
you
bye
think?
Bye-bye, William. Wow, that was excellent. I mean, I didn't get in from where he started, but mm-hmm. I tell you, I learned a lot. It was great to see all the work that he's doing, and it is wonderful to see that you still have people who care, because
yeah.
sometimes if you just stay back and watch the news, you just sit back and every now and then, I remember I was in Austin one time and a lady asked me if I ever get mad, and I told her, no, I don't get mad. I'm an activist. We don't get mad. We get results.
Right.
And then sometimes you watch TV and you know, every so often that little thought comes into your mind where, what the hell, maybe I should just think about myself, because
mm-hmm.
nobody really cares. And then you realize that's what they want you to do. And you get
that's
right
the end
back
game.
On board.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's the end game. That
exactly.
The hatred is palpable, and the anger is palpable. And when you talk about political parties and things like that, you talk about the Tea Party, there's no discussion available because you either have this opinion or you have that opinion. What I look at is the schism in between, where the people live. And it's absolutely inconscionable to have any idea that those who use the SNAP program, for instance, are just Democrats. Now,
right.
The perception has been, hang on, I'm going there, that it's lazy blacks that are on the SNAP program. It's those who have learned
mm-hmm.
how to game the system, who generationally have not worked and all of this. And then, you know, you get this one white boy that stands up and says, but I'm on SNAP. I'm hungry too, and I work two jobs. I've got a friend beside me that's been black his whole life, and he's got five kids, and he uses SNAP because he wants to feed his kids. What are you people talking about? It's not a matter of race. It's not a matter of anything other than the fact that we are not able to have meaningful jobs that pay us a respectable wage, that give us definable benefits like, you know, things like health insurance and retirement and pensions and things like that, because you government people have told our bosses that it's okay to take those things away from us and to leave us naked. And they hire us at their pleasure, and if they don't like it because it's Tuesday, they'll fire us. We have no job security. And there are 18 people for every one of us that are out there waiting on a job because they're the people who are on SNAP, for instance, that don't have a job. These are people that we weren't competing against last year or 2 years ago or 5 years ago. These are people that you have pushed into this realm with your ridiculous policies. And a lot of those people vote Republican. And a lot of them are Tea Party members. But we're all citizens. What are you going to do about this? And you have a party that says we're going to eliminate the program. We're going to give you the blessing of hard work. Are you? If you want to get people off the SNAP program, the best way to do it quickest is to generate jobs that are meaningful. Why aren't we talking about that? And the perception out there in the land is, in fact, I believe, changing. And it's changing because there are millions of people just like those who have been on SNAP for some time, who never, ever imagined themselves needing that kind of help. I don't believe that people are generationally taught how to live off the system. I've never met anybody, and I've had plenty of opportunities to do it in my own life, who was perfectly satisfied with their SNAP benefits as being their nutritional income. I never have. And if they're out there, I have yet to meet them. And if you'd like to call in, you know, please let us know how it is that you find living this way to be acceptable. And I'll guarantee you what they're going to tell me is it's not acceptable. It's about survival, because we're not talking about quality of life here. We're talking about life. If we don't have this program and if we don't have these benefits, we die. It's that simple. And the citizens out there in the country, across all political spectrums, I think, Egberto, are really finding, at least it's been my experience, that when they're offered the chance to voice their situation, they're quick to do it. And those are the people that we need to be listening to, and those are the conversations that we need to be having. How do we get them started?
I agree wholeheartedly, but I think it you're doing here, I think, is what has to be replicated over and over again. And I think if people listen both live and through podcast, your message, I think that message will be heard. I think your message will be heard. I think the way that you come across, you know, different messengers have different audiences that are susceptible to taking that message. I think that a show like yours is ultimately qualified in several regions around this country to get that message out. And I think I know you've been doing this outside of the realm of Coffee Party before. I think doing it within the realm here is that much more positive, and the potential for that much more reach. So I am just ecstatic about getting that message out through you.
I'm very happy to do it. This show is also being simulcast, which is a first for this show, on two other networks. And there are people who are hearing us from entirely different perspectives. And I want every one of those people to know that there is something you can do about this situation today. And it's really not so difficult. It doesn't require more of you than you think you can handle. The first thing you can do is understand that there are tens of millions of Americans, your fellow citizens, who don't know if they're going to have the next meal. If you realize that, and if you realize it just from the basis of your personal, individual reality, and if you understand that 8 out of 10 of those people are under the age of 18, and virtually the remainder of those people, for the greatest part, are over the age of 65, or they're veterans, or they are in poverty. They're working moms and dads. They're white, they're black, they're brown, they're yellow, they're red. They're hungry in America today. They're not hungry like, you know, I miss lunch. They're hungry like they've been hungry for the last year. They move from hunger to hunger. They graze at Walmart, which means they go in and they take all the free samples they can, because moms take their kids and put them in baskets because that's how the kids are going to eat. We have 8 million American families living in cars. We don't have the resources for the shelters that are needed. We don't have the resources to help these people get a hand up so that they can they can accept a job. You know, we have people who are quitting jobs because they're not getting the support they can get for, say, daycare. And they have to turn down shifts at work because of all of a sudden they've got this onset of medical conditions in their children that nobody can explain. It's not right that a kid should have scurvy in the United States. And that bothers me. It bothers me because I'm an American citizen, and it has always historically been the nature of the American people to help those who could not help themselves. The argument that the other side's saying is it is not that they can't help themselves, it's that they won't. We don't have any statistical data to prove that. We don't have anybody that we can bring to show. We just know that's the case. They're takers. And the reason they're takers is because the programs exist. If the programs didn't exist, they wouldn't be takers. Well, okay, they wouldn't be any better off either. What they'd be is on the street. We'd have Hoovervilles around this country, and we're getting them again. You know, the fastest rising population segment of America is the hobo. These are people who have been pushed as far as they can be pushed. There's nothing else for them except a grave. And I want those people to know that the Coffee Party, that Netroots Radio, that All American Radio, Westwood Media, we're not the mainstream, but we do offer the truth. And you can do something about this. You have a voice. You have the right as citizen to your voice to talk to your elected. You put them in office. Tell them that you will not accept this condition. Tell them that you will not accept their intransigence and their refusal to govern. And tell them you're hungry and ask them if they bring you a decent meal or if they rent out bedrooms or whatever it takes. That's what I'd like to see. And I'm not exactly sure how Coffee Party can exacerbate that and make that conversation more realistic from the consumer side. But I think if we can, we should. That's what I think. So that's my part on that. And Egberto is a rather amazing individual. I was interested. You know, the people who care the most tend to be those who have had the opportunity to see it up close and personal. William was talking about Haiti. I can talk about Africa or Cuba or Moldova or Russia. But Egberto can talk about it too. The people who are talking about this with the most passion are people who have lived the reality in their faces. Now, Egberto, where was it that you first came into this overwhelming hunger situation?
Well, I mean, I've seen right here in Houston, you know, from the time we live out in the suburbs of Houston in an area called Kingwood. Now, we always, from the time that my child was young, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, the one thing we always said is we always wanted her to see all sides of what it meant to be an American. In other words, I grew up a middle-class person. My wife grew up a middle-class person. But we always felt as we were moving forward that you don't have a real society. Everybody doesn't really have that opportunity. So even when we had our kid, we would take her to the food bank in the different organizations that we were a part of so that she could see what other kids had to go through. And I can tell you that my wife was out at the food lines in Houston last week, and she took a few of her friends with her, and she came home and she said, "You should have seen the reaction from a whole lot of her friends from this area. She didn't believe this." And one of them came from the Philippines. And the woman from the Philippines said, "I didn't know this existed in America." And that is more important than you would think.
Oh, yeah.
Because
as
Americans, we look at the Philippines. We look at where I'm originally from, Panama, and other places as third world countries where you know, you have that segment, a large segment of the society that live in poverty or starving or whatever. And we never, when I was coming up and I thought of America, I only thought of skyscrapers, freeways, and cars.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought America was. And to come and see what a lot of people are going through, and it's not a small percentage. It's not the people that just had it bad on their luck. It's something that is systematic. It is something that is occurring, I hate to say by design, but I think it is the commoditization of the American humanity, so that we have just a few. And you know what? Having those hunger people serve a purpose. The hungry serve a purpose. The hungry serve a purpose to that the middle class Americans that are on the bridge, on the edge, to look and say, I don't want to be like them. I better not buck the system.
Mm-hmm.
I better not go to this guy and ask him for a raise because I may be one of the hungry. I better not try to get ahead in my career because I may be one of the hungry.
When has that ever been the case in America?
Well, I tell you, do you remember 1929? Well,
wasn't
I know neither one. Neither one of us are old enough.
But my wife was, and
okay.
So was my dad, and so was
okay.
My mom.
Got you. And it is amazing how the progressive movement, believe it or not, well, you know that, but that is where we started to get human rights. I mean, human rights aren't just what was codified in the Constitution for men, but we got the 8-hour week, we got protections on the job, we got requirements for minimum wage. And all of that is what they're trying to take away right now. And believe it or not, high unemployment and starvation plays an important role in being a tipping point in one of either directions. And when I say that, I really mean it can be a tipping point where everybody rises up and demand, or it could be a tipping point where everybody is so scared that they may become that. And what we as people on this side are, I think, supposed to do is give it that nudge on the side that says, no, we want you to speak up and not fall off.
Right. And I think in order to do that, we have to give them permission, because the public view is that they need to shut up and go away. And
right.
That is a narrative that has been very carefully crafted by those who had changed this country, who don't like the country as it is, who, quite frankly, would rather do away with the Constitution and create a plutocratic corporatist theocracy in this country.
Exactly.
Now, if you want to play the long view, that's the goal. And the question is,
right.
is that sufficient for those who don't believe in that to rise up and say, no, not here?
Not yet. I don't think yet, because I think Obama served a purpose. You know, I remember I wrote a blog piece a while back that got us quite a bit of coverage, saying that Obama became president before it was his time. And what I meant by that is that the country was not really ready to elect a black president, but it was sort of like allowed, because in these bad times, we needed a scapegoat in these bad times. And how best to have a scapegoat than to have a guy like Obama come in and fail? You know, when the country was failing on his entrance into the presidency, how great would it be for him to be the president when all these different things are occurring, these negative things are occurring, to then force people in the next election to say, oh, maybe these guys were right after all. Of course, he was a bit too smart for them in a lot that he did to get the reelection in 2012. However, my fear is that I called a lot of times I called progressives and others looking for, weak-spined, because they cower as opposed to fight. And I think in a lot of ways that's what has happened over the long, the last 30 years. Progressives, progressives have been cowering. They've allowed supply side economics to somehow make sense to people, which it really does not. You know, they have reduced the role that economics like Krugman and Stiglitz and others have spoken about. I mean, I think that is a big problem.
Well, we have some more people on our phone line. Can you stay with us, Egberto?
I can stay a few more minutes, sure.
Okay, hang on. I want to bring on someone who's actually been actively involved in this situation from Greensboro, North Carolina. Tyler, are you with us?
Yes, but this isn't Tyler. Hi. This is Brown Beasley.
Well, hello, Brown Beasley. Welcome to our show. How are you?
I'm spectacular, but I'm improving. You know, I've listened to a few coffee party shows, and I don't like to think of myself as 1%
late. I don't know about his. That is his work.
Okay, I hear some feedback there. At any rate, I just now had an epiphany that coffee party is kind of a play on words in it. Yeah, the feedback's not coming from my end.
Okay, I've got it.
At any rate.
Go ahead, Todd. Go ahead.
I just realized that the coffee party is kind of like the antithesis or a alternative, so to speak, to the tea party. So it took me a little while to figure it out, but eventually it landed on me. I wanted to comment on what the speaker was just talking about as far as progressive allowing this supply side economics, or this large plutocracy that we see that's taken hold of our government. You know, this it's basically fascism. It's a corporate intermarriage with government. And the fact of the matter is that it really wasn't by choice, or was allowed. It was done pretty sly, and it was done sly by part of the implementation of what we have now was facilitated by Democrats.
It did. Well, it still takes two to tango.
Well, of course it takes two to tango, and I guess it was allowed if you would look at Clinton in terms of the NAFTA legislation, also with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which those two things alone, and of course there's others that I can continue on to, but those two things alone allowed for a greater flow of the jobs, and whether they be call center jobs or manufacturing jobs. They left the United States en masse and are never coming back, And also with allowing the banks to merge a commercial bank along with the trading enterprise an investment bank that trades, particularly the trades on such high leverage margins as investments such as derivatives, it set the stage. And I can continue. And then when we get into the Bush administration, and it's probably more before that, but we get into the Bush administration, this is getting a little bit off subject, but it's continual as to where we are today. After 9/11 and the Patriot Act, we started 13 years later. We have laws in effect such as the NDAA and, the Patriot Act on steroids. So not only are your civil liberties completely infringed upon, and it's written in law, the NDAA is something very dangerous, beyond dangerous. And, you know, there's more things that I could get into, but I don't think that it was allowed by the progressives. I think they threw curveball past us, and we don't, they sell something as doing one thing, but it actually does another. And I'm talking about NAFTA and Glass-Steagall.
That's one of the power strengths of the Republican Party. If anybody were to give them their due, they would say they certainly know how to frame a message.
The Democrats do it too. I don't see much of a difference.
Oh, I do.
I see them all being as corporate controlled, and neither one for looking out for the best interests of the people, okay. And that has us where we are today.
Well, thank you for your comment. I'm gonna let that sit for a minute. We've got some chat going on in the chat room. I hope you'll join us and continue, because I think you have a point to make that's important. And I thank you for calling us today, and I hope you'll call back again.
Very good. I'd like to hear what people are saying to what I had to say in the chat room. I'll listen.
Thank you. Okay.
Sure.
Hello, welcome to PPTS. Who am I talking to?
This is Eric Byler. Now, I just wanted to help you introduce Tyler Swanson, your next guest on the show from the Moral Monday Movement.
Okay. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how's it going?
Just
thanks
fine.
For joining Coffee Party Radio Network.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tyler is a college student. He was inspired by his political science professor to want to get more politically involved. I think that many people who study the civil rights movement and study the advancement of the suffrage to minorities and to women in our country see direct parallels between the struggle today and struggles at other times in our history when new people were entering into our electorate and there were different kinds of backlashes, often violent backlashes, to try to prevent them from being represented in the electorate. And so I think that Tyler and the young people who really sparked the Moral Monday movement by doing a march from the historic A&T University for voting rights early this spring, they see this as a continuum. And I think that Tyler, whom you're about to meet, is a young person who will really give you hope, give your listeners hope as well, that the young people do understand what they have inherited and they understand the role that they need to play in order to protect our democratic republic.
Well, can you hang on?
Yeah, I'll be listening.
We'll bring Tyler on. Tyler, are you with us?
Yeah.
Thank you. Welcome to PPTS, and I'm sorry for the hold. It's been a busy show. Welcome to us. Tell us your story.
Thank you. Well, you know, looking back on, you know, the civil rights movement, you know, that's really inspired me to get active in, you know, what was going on with North Carolina, really with the Voting Rights Act being challenged with the new voter ID bill that went into effect, really, you know, sparked my attention because, you know, African Americans really went through a lot just to obtain their right to vote. And with this voter ID bill, you know, it's just suppressing our vote. And so myself and a few other students from North Carolina A&T, we organized a march, and the name of the march was called Voters for Free Voting, Empowering the People.
Okay.
And what this march was really about was, you know, just telling, you know, trying to make some noise saying that we're against this voter ID bill because it's voter suppression. And that's what it was. And so we've invited, you know, Reverend Barber down, and he came and spoke. And then the next week we were down in the General Assembly with tapes over our mouths protesting the hearing of the bill. And I want to say the week after that, that's when, you know, Moral Monday had started. But what's so great with this movement and the movement, you know, back in the 60s, young people played a pivotal role back in the 60s and in the Moral Monday movement. And that's what you'll see, you know, although the media tries to, you know, portray young people as if we don't, you know, care what's going on or, you know, we're not interested, but we really are. And if you look and see, you know, if you look at the Moral Mondays, you'll see how young people came out and, you know, really played a role in this. And
yes.
And so that's what's so great. You know, North Carolina, you know, although the policies that are being implemented are taking us back 50 years, but really it's great to see young people stand up because these bills and what's going on is going to affect us more than any generation.
I agree with you. I agree with you. You know that you're one of the central target groups for suppression in North Carolina, right? Young people, college students?
Yes. They just don't – our General Assembly just doesn't like us for some reason. And
what was the outcome of their attempt to deny your vote as a college student if you weren't registered where you went to school?
Right. It's. I mean, they're attacking the voting rights, you know, higher education, you know, they're making that harder. So, really, we are being attacked. And
yes,
I just hope that, you know, with all of this going on, you know, it'll spark more young people. And, you know, the conversation that we're having on campus, you know, a lot of – a lot of students are very upset with what's going on in Raleigh, and they're interested in getting involved and, you know, try to make a difference. And I think, you know, only good thing that the General Assembly has done is brought us all together. They've, you know,
Boy, they didn't intend to do that, I'll tell you.
Right, but they've upset, you know, the older generation, the younger generation, teachers, the LGBT community. They've pretty much just discriminated against the entire, all of the North Carolinians here. So we've all came together and, you know, fighting for justice, which is a great thing. And, you know, we have nobody else to thank but Governor McCrory, Art Pope, Tom Tillis, and Phil Berger. That's who we owe this big thanks to.
Yes, it's kind of hard to call them as a group prejudice because they just hate everybody.
Yeah, they don't discriminate.
I have Egberto on the line, and I have Eric on the line. Would you guys like to talk to Tyler and ask him any questions?
Well, I would like to tell Tyler, first of all, thank you, because that has always been my biggest fear. You know, I have a daughter likely around your age, 22, and there are times that she wasn't as politically engaged that I would have hoped, and now she is. And listening to folks like you and listening to what you guys did both in North Carolina and Florida really gives me hope, and I hope guys like yourself will this is where I must humble myself to you guys. Tell us how folks in our generation can actually be of the right type of service that continue to not only get you guys engaged now, but increase your numbers. That is the kinds of things that we need to know. We would love to know for you to come on board and tell us how can we best engage you to ensure that you are a part of this body politic for change.
Tyler?
Yes.
Go ahead.
You know, the only way that I could, you know, kind of answer this is by you know, continuing, you know, to have these conversations and, you know, just have a good conversation and, you know, brainstorm and organize, because really and truly we can all learn from each other, and that's what, you know, we've done. We've learned from, you know, the older generation, the younger generation, you know, because, like I said, we don't know everything, and you guys have experienced this before, some of your generation and some, you know, a little bit older than you guys, and it's best, you know, to get both fields and then try to come up with a great solution. I think that's what we've done, but we still have a lot of work to do, if that answers your question.
Have you got any mechanism in place, Tyler, where you are in North Carolina to interact or to communicate or discuss or have discourse with adults? I mean, not adults, but older Americans. It's continually my surprise that we find ourselves at this stage having to learn from the children, but I shouldn't be. It's just my first experience with it. It's generational. It happens every time. But how are you interacting with the older adults?
Well, I know here on campus at here at North Carolina A&T, we haven't reached out to the community yet. We're, you know, organizing here on campus by, you know, trying to, you know, come up with a platform that, you know, builds all of these issues that we're facing and going from there. But like I said, I know we've reached out to some of the community, and, you know, the community has spoke with us, but we haven't really, we haven't really done as much as I would hope we would have done yet with this local election. Now, that's really what we're focusing on, but now that the election's over with, I'm hoping now that we can really go back and focus on what the General Assembly is doing to, you know, to discriminate against the people before we all disperse for Christmas break.
Okay. Eric, are these stories writing themselves?
Hold on one second.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things I want to say about Moral Monday is that it did actually bring the generations together every Monday for 12 or 13 weeks in a row. You saw the young people, you saw people in their 80s, and the arrestees ranged from age 18 all the way up to like 83. I think one was even 85.
And it wasn't just that they would get arrested in the General Assembly, but they also, there was an entire day that they spent together. It would begin in a church, and then there'd be people who would sort of volunteer to be arrested, and then there'd be people who were there just to support them and cheer them on. And then there'd be legal advice given to those who were to be arrested. And it would go all the way through an entire day where there'd be a rally outside of the General Assembly building, and then they would march in this really elegant, you know, beautifully staged march. And then, you know, the police would give them warnings and eventually start arresting people, but they'd get in several speeches, and there'd always be a diversity of people, women, men, minorities, clergy, millionaires, and poor people. I mean, just a great diversity of people who would give, you know, be given a chance to speak, usually people that they had just met that day at the church. And then there would be this bus farewell, where the people who are arrested inside the building are cheered on as they're loaded onto the bus, and they're just—it would be almost like a football rally or something. Just the camaraderie that people would share, chanting and singing together, and they would do that for hours. And then many of them would go to the jail, where people were being let out, and cheer them and greet them and feed them as they got out of jail. And then they would have a party back at the church. So it really was a place for old people and young people to share experiences. And I was thinking Tyler could comment on that, and perhaps also on the trip to Selma that he took recently with Annabelle and I, filming for Story of America.
I think that's perfect. Tyler, were you arrested?
I was. I was arrested on May 13th with my political science professor, Professor Smith. We went in the week after the semester had ended, and like I said, once you – I call it a Moral Monday justice program, because that's what it is. You know, it's like a family reunion. Each week you go, you know, you see your jailbird family, and then, you know, the jailbird family keeps adding. We were over 900.
Wow.
So this was a little over 900 who was arrested within the past 17 weeks of Moral Monday. So it's, in a way, it's one of the greatest experiences that I've, you know, ever experienced. You know, just hearing some of the stories of individuals who fought this back in the 60s and 70s, and here they're fighting it again. It inspired me to continue to do a little bit more.
You were arrested voluntarily. I mean, you chose to be arrested. What were you charged with?
I was charged with second-degree trespassing, failure to disperse, and breaking the building code.
Okay. And what was the result of that?
All of my charges were dismissed. However, we still have a few who are still fighting their charges, but I did my community service, and then my charge was dismissed. I had a really great attorney, Attorney Gita Kapoor, who was outstanding.
Okay. And did you ever go to court?
I went to court for the first hearing, and then my attorney, you know, she went to court for me after that.
Okay. Now, Eric's telling me about a trip you took. You want to tell me about that?
Yes. We went to Alabama the week of Memorial. Yes, Memorial weekend. It was that was another great humbling experience. You know, just seeing all the rich history that they have in Selma, Alabama. And, you know, in a way, it reminded me of, you know, what's going on here in North Carolina. You know, they're crying out for help. They just, you know, they need the help, but they, you know, need a little bit of inspiration. You know, talking with Eric and Annabelle and Bob Zellner, who was a former SNCC member, you know, we came up with the idea of trying to, you know, create a Moral Monday down in Alabama, which would definitely benefit them. And, you know, doing what we're doing here in North Carolina, that would, you know, give them a model of how to go about it. But nothing is never impossible. It's just going to require a lot of work. And I'm sure, hopefully over the summer and whatnot, we'll be able to get all that together.
If you could say that you had a takeaway from that trip with Eric and Annabelle, what would you say your takeaway was?
I was so many. I would say the one I had to choose, it would be when we met Miss Joanne Bland, who was 11 years old during the Bloody Sunday March. And, you know, just hearing her story, how, you know, she was 11 years old and going through such a horrific event, you know, how it changed, you know, changed her life. That, you know, really, really was something I had to take back. You know, I still reflect over the trip now just thinking, you know, I can do a little bit more here to help organize and whatnot.
Well, I think that those examples are important, but it's also kind of revealing because it's obvious that you found something of yourself in Miss Julie. And that was 50 years ago?
Yeah.
So we find two generations, not quite. We have two generations separated by distance who find themselves with exactly the same things going on in their world. The difference is that what we have from Bloody Sunday and from the marches in Selma and Montgomery and things like that is perspective. We see historically what happened, and we try to figure out why it happened. What I would think I'd want to know from you is, did you gain a perspective on your work that you didn't have when you went to Alabama?
Yes, I would. Because, you know, in a way, you know, when I got involved in this movement, you know, it was just something that, you know, that I was supposed to do. It's just, you know, it felt right. And, you know, just in a way, like I said, the trip there inspired me and inspired them. So it was an inspirational trip. It really was. And like I said, I'm just humbled to be a part of that experience.
Well, it sounds to me like you're a lightning rod or a spark plug for the organization that you're dealing with there in on campus. And it gives your message a sense of legitimacy, I think. And that's one of the things that each of the people that have talked on our show today have brought us, from Eric to Egberto to William to others to Beasley. It's legitimacy. You're in the fight. You're on the ground, and you have a message that you feel is terrifically important for people to hear. Is there anything we can do to help you get that message out?
You know, the good thing that we have now that they didn't have back there in the 60s is social media.
True.
And really, that's what's really, you know, helped this movement, because Moral Mondays is known worldwide, and that's definitely through social media. So the only thing that I could say, you know, we, you know, just continue to get the story out through the media, because that's what's definitely going to help get the story out to different countries who are kind of similar to North Carolina, but they just don't know how to organize. So just using what, you know, Reverend Barber and Reverend Gatewood have done with the NAACP chapter, that can definitely, you know, shed a light of hope to these other cities and states around the United States.
Well, you bring the hope with you. And
thank you.
I'm grateful that you do. I think that what you're doing is terrifically important. And I think that it's your responsibility because it's your turn. But that doesn't mean that while you may have to do a lot of things by yourself, you don't have to do anything alone. And if you ever need a voice, if you ever need a place for that voice, I promise you that this show will offer you that voice.
Well, thank you so much.
And thank you for what you're doing, and thank you as a citizen. I appreciate you standing up for me as well. Egberto, is there anything you'd like to share with us?
I would just like to thank him as well. I just think, like I said before, it is wonderful to see young people get engaged, and I think that is what should really steer the plutocracy. And I think part of the reason that we have the problems that we have from suppression in North Carolina and Texas and other places is the fear that there are going to be a lot more of him around.
I think you're absolutely right. I think if there's anything, regardless of the issue, whether we're talking about pushing people over the hunger cliff, whether we're talking about education, health care, social justice, criminal justice, or any other of the other battles that we're having to face purposely, maliciously, by an uncaring group, the one thing that terrifies them most is the population they don't yet control. and that is the young people, the new voter, the independent voter, which, of course, we saw in this last election, had a significant impact on the outcome. I think that it's important for Tyler to understand, first of all, just take it from me. I'm just one guy, Tyler. But take it from me that you're doing the most important work that can be done right now. You're being a citizen. And I think that what you're doing is terrific, and I hope that it spreads across the country like wildfire. I really do. I want your generation to become not only engaged, but active to the point of solution creation. I want you to create the solutions to these problems that have been set upon you unwillingly and unknowingly. You didn't do it, but you can fix it. And I want everybody to know that Egberto is exactly right. You need to understand that the powers that are arrayed against you, okay, have a lot of money. They have a lot of influence. But they don't have a voice. You do. And your voice speaking truth to power enables you to become the change you seek. And I want you to take that home with you and understand it. You are doing what needs to be done, and you're doing it well. And on behalf of the Coffee Party, NetRich Radio, American Network, and Westwood Media, I believe that all of our listeners would agree with me in saying you are our hero. And you need to know that your work is not in vain and that your work is not being ignored. So go forth with all due diligence. And if it happens in your local campus, it can happen at another one. And then you become trainable, and then you go out and train others to do it. And it's just like this. It's not the first spark in the darkness that matters, Tyler. It's the second one. And you represent that second one. And I thank you for what you're doing. And thank you for being with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
You bet. Right. Eric, are you willing to talk to me a minute?
Sure, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. We've got Egberto here with us. And I wanted to know what your individual assessment of the show is today so that we can move forward appropriately according to Coffee Party guidelines.
Mm-hmm. I'm very glad that you've joined the lineup of shows that we have on the Coffee Party Radio Network. I think that an alliance between Americans, North and South, is something that's been a long time coming in this country. And I think that a lot of the political pitfalls that we face today are because we haven't really come to terms with the divisions that led to our Civil War and that grew out of our Civil War. So much of this struggle over voting rights really stems from the backlash against the suffrage that was granted to African-American men at the time after the Civil War. And, you know, in the very same way that the white line groups and the red shirt groups and the Ku Klux Klan formed in order to prevent African-Americans from voting back at that time, and they were successful for 100 years, you could make some of the same arguments that are being made today in North Carolina that they made then, and that is that, yeah, democracy is all good and fine and everything, but if the outcome is going to be different from what we want, then we need to address that at the polls. We need to prevent certain people from voting so that we can have the outcome that we want. It's just politics. It's not hatred. It's just politics. And I think that we need to embrace an idea of America that puts democracy and the notion of self-governance and the notion of equality above any kind of a partisan sort of a preference for outcome. I think that the outcome should be second to preserving the sanctity of the process.
Egberto?
I loved your show. when I got the message on the that it was actually starting up today, I came on it right away. I hadn't noticed that it was going to be at 2 today, and when Janine placed it on my page, it was like, oh God, I need to call in. I enjoyed the show. I enjoyed your guests. I enjoy actually the flavor that you give the show. So thank you very much.
Well, I want us to go together as a party. Everything ties together at that point, I think. It's not a party that you would normally, for instance, see on a ballot, because it's not a party in fact, it's a movement. It is an opportunity for American citizens to come together and exercise their franchise on a regular basis about those things which they are passionate about, to bring civility it's this foreign term, it seems, in Washington these days, to the conversation where we can ask, yeah, but what does it do for American citizens? I've missed that question for so long. There are those who have voices. Of course, Senator Bernie Sanders comes to mind. Bill Pascrell comes to mind. Who are, as hard as it is for American citizens to feel entitled to have a voice, these are the examples of what happens when your voice is heard. And I can't say enough how much I appreciate you guys, because you're making the availability of a place and a support system where someone can come here and say, I'm just a guy, I'm just Joe Schmo, but I want to know why they're taking my ability to feed my family away from me. I want to hear them explain to me in terms that I can understand, even if I don't accept what they believe to be the case. That's a conversation which needs to be held, and I'd like it to be held nowhere else than here. And I will tell you, I've reached out to several of those people who have rather consistently, but nonetheless, declined to be on our show. I hope that they'll listen to it. It's in our archives. We'll replay it on Thursday night on Networks Radio, beginning at 9 Pacific time. And we'll have a chat room available, and they'll be invited to come and respond to that too, because we don't really have a positional center here. You know, this is not a Democratic, it's a progressive idea, but there are progressives on both sides of the aisle. What I want to do is to reduce it to the American citizen, because at that point, I think that's where the best change can happen. I don't think that, you know, Egberto, I've been a fan of yours for a long time now, and superior writing causes action. William's writing was incredible because it defied its readers not to take action. And if there's something that this show can do, it is to help people answer one simple question. What are you going to do about it? And that means today. That means where you live. It doesn't mean on a national level, running for federal office. It means under your roof. How are you going to explain to your children what their obligations and responsibilities are, and how are we going to tell that story to the American people, which is why it's so wonderful that the three of us are here, because between us, we have the opportunity to do that. Eric's telling the story on film, Egberto's telling it in writing, and of course, we got the radio that everybody's involved with. It's an important story, and it needs to be told. If we can get that conversation started, if we can find the points like Tyler and Beasley William and all the others to at least tell us that something is happening. We are doing something about this, and we invite people to become engaged with us. That's so empowering, because the one thing I think above all others that regardless of stripe, American citizens lack today is the belief that they have permission. I hear Egberto every week, you know, talking about who are you bringing with? Who are you able to influence? What do you mean? I can influence anybody. I'm just a guy. I'm just a gal. I'm a mother. I try to influence my kids. You know, Eric's out there telling the story every week of people who are mothers with kids, single guys. You know, this is their reality. And if we can give them voice, if we can let them know that there are lots more than just two sparks in the darkness. Those guys who would do this to us are going to continue to be terrified. I think they're going to feel it very strongly for the next few cycles in the electoral process as well. And if we can do that, we can win this battle. We can return America to the greatness that she has. It may not be the great, you know, the greatness that we've ever seen, but we can at least return to the core values that make us Americans. And I've heard that throughout the show. Everybody wants to be that America, and they don't know how. So let's show them. And the coffee party is a wonderful place to do that. I invite anybody in the world that would like to find a voice about a passion or a cause to go to coffeepartyusa.org and listen to these shows, interact with the host, get involved in the party. There's volunteer. Eric, you're still taking volunteers, aren't you?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Is there any particular volunteer areas that are particularly necessary right now?
Well, we're about to launch something new that is going to be in partnership with an organization called Represent.Us, and it's to basically form local citizens groups in each congressional district to push the passage of the Anti-Corruption Act. So you'll be hearing more about that on future shows, but what we'll be asking you to do is to write to your congressman, get a yes or no on support for the Anti-Corruption Act, and then start to pressure them to get more yeses, and then eventually when it comes to election time, we'll be asking people to support those people who, those candidates or Congress members of Congress who will support to give a law that will help to mitigate the corrupting influence of money in politics.
Excellent. Excellent. Egberto, what's happening in your world as far as this movement goes?
Well, I am on board. The Represent.Us is what we're working on. I think John Aris Anderson is carrying the ball on that. And the person that in our group that takes care of getting members is, I'm getting old, Eric. Help me out.
do you mean Dan Aronson? Or you mean Deb?
No.
Williams?
No, I'm talking about who takes care of taking our volunteers. Processing our
Dale Williams. Yeah, that's
Dale Williams. Dale Williams, yeah.
Dale Williams, okay. And do you happen to know an email for him? Or is there a coffee party email that people can contact?
Dale is a woman, actually. If you go to coffeepartyusa.com and hit volunteer, you'll be put directly in touch with her.
There you go. That's all I need to know.
Gentlemen, and by the way, I think it's coffeepartyusa.com, not .org.
It is com, yeah. I remember that after I said it. It's coffeepartyusa.com. And if our listeners would like to go there and find out what's available, we encourage you to do that. You can go to netrootsradio.com. You can go to any number of sources that you can connect to from those sites and find out that there is something you can do about this. There really, I promise, there's something you as a citizen can do about this that will affect positive change. You've heard some of the voices here that are leading the way, leaders all. And I thank you for being with me today. I very much appreciate it. We have an open invitation to Rachel Wilsey to appear on this show. If Catherine from Colorado Hunger Project would like to spend time, anybody who would like to come on the show is perfectly welcome. And we look forward to seeing you next week on Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, where for the last 2 hours, coming to your left from slightly left of Nashville, I have been the Tennessee Progressive. Thank you all very much for your participation today, and we'll talk to you next time, okay? Bye-bye for now. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.